We are still very much tweaking the format of these events, and sometimes it's better to just kind of go with what you have than scramble and try to find something that's not there. So Micah was here and available, and I was very interested in the project that he's doing. And so I said, the floor is yours, man.
All right.
On days like today, you know, we think about the value of religion. We think about, at its best, at its very best, religion can be something that gives consolation. It can be something that gives peace. It can be something that helps us find purpose when things are rough. But at its worst, it can divide people in really awful ways. And so that's kind of what I wanted the focus of our conversation to be. And so Micah Naziri is here, and he's a doctoral student, Antioch University's Leadership and Change Program. And his focus has been on applying his foundation in Judeo-Sufi studies and Mizrahi Middle Eastern Jewish communities, past and present, towards bridge building between Jewish and Muslim communities. Specifically from his doctoral work, nearly 24 chapters worldwide of Hashlama Project study circles have begun forming in response to his call for Jews and Muslims to come together in dialogue, respectful engagement of varying perspectives, and co-worship, all following the model of Judeo-Sufi pietistic communities from the medieval period. So this is Micah.
Now that's like from what I sent you,
that's
right?
That's what he sent.
I'm like, that sounds good. Did he make that up? Okay. Well, this is as you noted, sort of laid back and impromptu. I didn't honestly plan like a format of. I just figured I'm going to talk with you guys about this. As you noted, I'm in the Leadership and Change program, and the Hashlama Project, in a lot of ways, has been an outgrowth of what I intend for my thesis work to be. So whereas a lot of times people are sort of figuring out all along the way, you know, like, well, what am I going to do my thesis on? I've really, and I was telling him this before, I've really had the support of the faculty in that they've been really encouraging this project, the Hashlama Project, as something central to what my thesis is going to be. And as it is the Leadership and Change program, it's very action driven, you know. So the different chapters that you mentioned, the 20 or almost 20 chapters all around the world, are really the action part of it, you know, not just theory, not just looking at history. Jewish and Muslim communities got together, but basically, how can this happen again? How can we use models from history that are proven to have worked well, not just for 10 years in this region or whatever, but for centuries and throughout Al-Andalus, Portugal and Spain, North Africa, the Yemen, and the Levant, different parts, not so much in some other parts, but also for like 6 centuries, you know, this was something that was going on for a while. So that, you know, the action part is, and that's the more or less new thing, is how can we implement that? How can we, you know, start getting folks together? And almost overnight, I guess it was overnight, once I kind of figured out bouncing ideas off of different people, some people who I've been working with Hashlama stuff for a while, some people, advisors at school. Once I figured out the sort of vision for that action part of it, for those study circles, literally overnight there were people stepping up all over the world that I knew who said, yeah, this is great, let's go with it. And sometimes it's been surprising. I think within the first weekend there were like 8. There were like 8 chapters, you know. And so a lot of that was people pledging, saying, I'm willing to do this, but I don't know, you know, I don't know how, you know. And other times it was people who had been following things that I was writing on this subject, including my master's thesis, who were all about it. And they said, oh, this is great. I know, you know, X, Y, and Z people who were going to be down for it. And they put the word out and they started having meetings right away. Here in Ohio, we've had relatively small turnout, so that's why I said I wouldn't be disappointed even if it was the three of us, because sometimes it's been three people and sometimes it's been five people. It's not like there are people, you know, at shul or at a mosque who are just, you know, yeah, let me go do this. And part of the problem, and this is really a problem with our Israeli chapters, part of the problem is in some communities there's not just animosity, but there's sometimes fear. And especially in Israel, there's a lot of fear of Muslims. And sometimes when people talk aggressively or talk tough about the perceived other, it's because of fear. And so some of the folks there, we have a Jerusalem and Tel Aviv chapter, and then we have... And these are just barely forming, just budding chapters there. And then we have one that's that's just outside of Jerusalem, technically in the West Bank. And so there are some issues that we're sorting out, you know, because one day some of these people will be really gung-ho, and then the reality of it, they'll start putting out flyers for meetings or something, and people will be like, oh man, what if people actually show up to this, you know? What am I going to do then? So really, the idea is, first and foremost, for people to get to know each other, Muslims and Jews to get under the same roof and talk to one another and take down those barriers a little bit. And to share, additionally, to share aspects of one another's traditions, one another's worship, in a fairly unstructured manner. There's not like a list of rules, nor will there be, per se. Like, at 15 minutes you do this, then the next, you know, half an hour you do this, and then everybody... gets together and prays, and then they hug, and then you have debate, and then you hug. But, you know, but I kind of have some, you know, like, for me, that's kind of my idea of what it, you know, should look like for me. In New York, we've got, you know, a yoga teacher, we've got an arts therapist, activist, and people like that who, the way that they would put something together would be very different than how I would. You know, I'm, you know, a doctoral student, a martial arts teacher, an arts background, this very eclectic, bizarre individual. And sometimes I have, like, you know, a very idealistic way of even how these meetings should go. Now, like I said, these are based somewhat on historical models. The idea is that we're not reinventing the wheel. Let's put it this way. If I were to phrase a question to a lot of Muslims, a lot of Jews, Israelis, Palestinians, anybody, and say, do you think, not tell them any background of this, say, do you think it's possible that Jews and Muslims could come together and share these things and blah, 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 you know, and worship together even, and, you know, pray together, blah, blah, blah. I would say that most people would say, well, maybe someday. And I would say that because I've had conversations like this with people, you know. And I think to some extent I was even like that, you know. When I discovered the background as you were saying in that great, eloquent introduction, of some of these Judeo-Sufi rabbis, which is the sort of scholarly term. They didn't go around saying, hey, we're Judeo-Sufi rabbis, you know. They were rabbis who hung out with Muslim Sufis, and would have meditation retreats sometimes with them, pray with them sometimes. Sometimes would look at the Sufi model of worship and reintroduce things that they saw as Judaic, as Jewish, to their communities and say, yeah, they got it right. That's what we used to do. And for instance, in Kifayat al-Abidin, which is the book where the son of Maimonides, one of the most famous rabbis and Jewish philosophers of all time, Avraham ben Rambam, he actually lays out in that book how he thought Jews should pray. And he believed that Jews should readopt the prayer postures that Muslims were doing. And he said, this isn't something that they came up with, you know. So if you start engaging in these postures with Jewish prayer, don't let your neighbor talk down on you or look down on you and say, oh, you're doing what the Muslims are doing, because they got it from us. We're not, you know, we may be restoring it, but they ultimately got these things from a Judeo milieu, you know. And that kind of resolved it for his community. He was the head of Egyptian Jewry, and he led basically all of Egypt's Jews in things like this, and these sort of Sufic expressions of pietism. And he wasn't the only one. It wasn't just like, you know, so I've told this to some people, and they said, well, you know, that was the Rambam's son, you know. Like, but we know what Maimonides thought about him. He said that there was nobody who even came close to the piety of his son. He had one son. So it wasn't like the other son, you know. Wait, maybe you meant the other guy. You know, this guy's a little weird. You know, he said, this is it. If you want to see a model for piety, it's Abraham. And this didn't just end with him. This went on for centuries with the Maimonidean dynasty. There was never backpedaling. There was never backtracking. Through, as far as we know, as far down as it goes, through the Maimonidean line, until we just totally lose track of them centuries later, they were all engaged in this sort of Judeo-Sufi stuff. Not just that, but they get even more tight-knit with the Sufis. Still never leaving Judaism, never trying to get Muslims to convert to Judaism, the Sufis not trying to get Jews to convert to Islam in these circles. Yeah, certainly there were. Maimonides' whole family was driven out of Al-Andalus by the Almohades when they, you know, came up and said, you know, convert or die. So there were bad things going on too. And part of what I ideally want these projects to focus on is not just the history that's good, but also looking at history that's bad and how that is important for both parties, Jews and Muslims alike, in order to acknowledge the bad and say, you know, how can we learn from the good and how can we learn from the bad? And how can we learn that some of these bad things that have happened have built up the walls that we need to tear down? Because when you have, and you see it a lot with Israeli-Palestinian debates, whenever, even here, you know, when if people start debating Israel and Palestine stuff, it usually becomes one side on one side and the other side on the other side. There's never a discussion of shared responsibility, almost never. There's never, or almost never, here I go saying never all the time, but there is rarely one side looking with brutal honesty at how some people on their side may have done some very wrong things. I often give the example of Menachem Begin, who, when Ben-Gurion said, when he first heard him speak, heard him on the radio, and he said, he thought it was Adolf Hitler. He said it was Hitlerite. And Menachem Begin, of course, went on to do some bad things, long before his career in politics. So I say, if Ben-Gurion could be that honest, that brutally honest about Menachem Begin, I think we all can be, you know. And conversely, I've worked with a lot of Palestinian activists, and I say, have you ever heard of Haj Amin al-Husseini? And almost without exception, I've never met even one who does. Even, you know, older folks, usually never met anybody. He was the Grand Mufti. And in Jewish circles, especially with educated and educators who are Jews, I noticed that almost everybody has heard of him. He was funded by the Third Reich. He and his brother went to Iraq in 1941 and kicked off a pogrom against the Jewish people there with Nazi funding, something I have documentation, hard copy from the Arab Higher Committee in my hand, so to speak, at my house. It's not hidden history. It's not some, you know, it's not like, look, this is this big expose, and if I can tell people this, then this will, you know. But why I say that is not just because it's important for us to look with brutal honesty at things that have gone wrong. I don't want to say that both sides have done wrong, because I think this notion of there being sides is wrong. That some people who associate themselves with one side and some people who associate themselves with the other side have done wrong. And the vast majority on both sides not only haven't done any of those things, but in many cases, they don't even know about what those people on their so-called side did. And that's why I point this out about 99.9% of Palestinians I've talked to have never heard of this guy. Finally, when he was driven out of Mandate Arab Palestine, he was a guest in Berlin of Adolf Hitler. He helped the Nazis set up the Handschar Division of the SS, which was composed of Bosnian Muslims. Like I said, a lot of Jews know about this, you know. Ben Zvi wrote a book, The Exiled and the Redeemed. You have leaders of Israel who, and in that book, he's talking about things like this. He's talking about myths and stories in the Muslim world that the average Muslim doesn't know about. And he's talking about it. He's talking about the massacre, the legendary massacre of the Banu Qurayza. He's talking about it as though the common Muslim knows about this and believes that 900 Jews had their heads chopped off in the Medina marketplace by Muhammad, even though this story was written 150-some years, the first time ever set to pen, 150-some years after Muhammad was gone. It was written after a Jewish uprising against the caliphate, which Muhammad's own family rebelled against as well. To give some context to that, it wasn't just like the Jewish people were like, oh, we don't like this caliphate, and the Muslim people were like, ah, they're cool, you know? And Muhammad's own family rebelled against them. And then all of a sudden you see this new emergence of anti-Jewish propaganda. And we don't have any of the Jewish community writing about it. Nobody's heard of it. 150 years. Nobody's heard of this story. So when Ben Zvi's writing about it, he's under the impression that this is history, that this is true. You know, somebody wrote it a long time ago. It's got to be true. So part of what I try to emphasize with the Hashlama Project is not just looking brutally at things that did happen, but also looking brutally in a historical critical manner about how our ideas of history also play into this, how our wrong ideas of what's history play into this. Like I said, I bring up the thing about Palestinians and the Grand Mufti because whenever I've brought this up and I say, well, you've never heard of him. You've never heard of this guy. But a lot of, I would say most Israeli leaders have heard about Der Gross Mufti. And if they've heard of him and you haven't heard of him, and they're wanting you to acknowledge that that there was this bad guy who was, Yasser Arafat considered him his uncle. Well, he probably wasn't really his uncle, but he said this guy was his uncle. There's not really any evidence for that. But when there are the extremists, and I'm not going to get in a debate about Yasser Arafat and whether or not he constitutes, you know, extremism, but certainly when he was, saying that this guy was his uncle, he would fall into that category. When you have extremists that idolize and idealize bad guys like this, and the Israeli Jewish community is looking to Palestinians saying, why don't they acknowledge that there was this guy who was in cahoots with the Nazis? This was their leader, and that's how it's perceived. And yet the average Palestinian is like, I've never even heard of this guy. I don't know what you're talking about, you know? How, you know, and then if you start saying all this stuff, you're just making that up, you know? So history is important, and it's also, you know, something that we can fall into the trap of looking at history from way back in too straightforward of a manner, taking things at face value. So on some level, some of the historical critical revisionism, with a capital R, in a good sense. I mean, revision is not a dirty word. You know, when people on Fox News or something talk about that someone being a historical revisionist, Israeli historiography, the new historian movement is revisionism, but it's historical critical revisionism. It's saying, like Britain, there was an expiration on Israeli documents and when things could come out, you know, they're declassified. Once things were declassified, a lot of the founding myths of Israel as a nation, some of these things conflicted with them. There was some ugly stuff that went on with some people, with some groups. I would argue that it was in contrast to and in defiance of Haganah orders. There were Haganah orders, don't burn villages, don't execute people and drive them out. But stuff like that did happen. And we know for sure because there's declassified files now. So in the same way that Israeli Jews are waiting for Palestinians to take ownership of, you know, say, well, this guy was a bad Palestinian leader. And this wasn't ancient history. This was a bad guy. He was funded by the Nazis. He didn't just, like, not want people to be driven out of their homes. He didn't, you know, long before that, he wanted Jews dead, period. The same way that Israeli Jews are waiting for that sort of, I don't know if ownership's the right word, but basically they want history to be looked at and they want dignity. They want Palestinian people to say, yeah, that was wrong. Let's move on. In the same way, the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Muslim people, and to some extent some Christians, they want Israelis and they want Jews abroad to say, look, we know your family isn't just making this up. We know some bad stuff happened, you know, and we're sorry about that, you know, and let's try to move forward from here because we're not, you know, nobody's going back to any other place. You know, this idea that people have of Israel being all European Jews in the first place is incorrect because millions of Arabian Jews fled to Israel. And a guy I know, he's a relative of Shimon Peres, I was talking about this to him. I said, yeah, most of you guys have like a parent or a grandparent who's basically an Arab Jew, you know? And he's like, yeah, I didn't come to think of it. I have a grandparent who's, you know, who's from wherever, Morocco or something, you know? And, you know, so even though he identifies as an Ashkenazi European Jew, he's still got an Arabian background, you know? So this whole idea that Israel just, you know, the Holocaust was going on and all the European Jews came there and that's it. And there weren't millions of... It's so complicated. It's such a complicated situation. And nobody's just going back. You know, who was that? There was a lady who was a reporter, and her career kind of ended when she had mentioned, you know, the Jews just need to go back to, I think she's Lebanese, she said Jews just need to go back to Poland and to Russia, and, you know, and I mean, she was a reporter, she was educated, she should know that even if that was what she thought was right to have happen, that's just not the demographic makeup of the Israeli population, except in some maybe really Orthodox communities, or really Orthodox Ashkenazi communities that might keep to themselves. So, you know, when this stuff that I'm just kind of rattling off gets talked about at Hoffman Project study circles, usually, and because it's face-to-face, usually both sides are like, I didn't know that. The other side, I didn't know that. And when you talk about these things and inform people of, there's something that side believes, and they believe it for a right reason, not because they're stupid and not because they hate you. Now, they might also hate you, you know, but that's a different issue, you know. Ultimately, well, let's say it like this. There's a sort of famous rabbinic maxim that a rabbi had, two disciples, and one of them, well, they were both arguing. And one of them comes up to him because he's, I'm going to settle this, you know, I'm going to our rabbi. So he says, Rabbi, you know, who's arguing with him? And I was saying such and such. And, you know, isn't that right? And he says, yeah, that's right. Another one says, no, but Rabbi, such and such. You know, and he argues his position then. And he goes, ah, you're right. And then they both look at each other, and they look at the right. We can't both be right. And he says, you're right. You know, so this is ultimately the premise that, if I had to sum it up, that the Hashlama Project is about. Everybody can be right from a certain perspective, but everybody can also be wrong simultaneously by failing to see the perspective of someone else. Because the only way that both of them couldn't be right, and when he said, they said, we can't both be right, and he said, you're right. The only way that they were both not able to be right is because they were unwilling to look at the other's perspective. If they were willing to look at the other one's perspective, then they both could have been right. And so that's kind of the gist of it. Getting people to look at things from, you know, the perceived other's perspective. So in that sense, there's that element of history. And these are called Hashlama Project study circles. There is, you know, it's not just a Hashlama Project social hour. Jews and Muslims get together and have some hummus and, you know, and hope everything turns out well, you know. there is an element of study. There is an element of looking at history. So that's one aspect of it, and that's somewhat the more modern aspect. And the other aspect is looking at things like how the communities of the Maimonidean dynasty did things, and not just them, but Rabbeinu Bahia ben Pakuda in Al-Andalus, which might sound obscure. Who's Bahia ben Pakuda? But his work, Chovot HaLevavot, Duties of the Hearts, is still used in Orthodox yeshivot today as required reading. Now, what is it? It was originally written in Judeo-Arabic. It was... it escapes me. Al-Fara'id ila al-Qulub, which just means the same thing, sort of the, you know, the duties, the fara'id, is plural of a typically Islamic word, fard, meaning a religious obligation. So even in the original Judeo-Arabic title, he's employing typically Islamic words, and throughout it, he's using, you know, Sufi Arabic words, not just that they're incidentally Arabic, that they're pregnant with Sufi meaning, and even talking about kulub, or which is plural of kalb. If you pick up any book, even in English, on Sufism, there's all this attention to the heart, you know, and the heart's like this cosmic thing. It's almost like this is like the receiver, you know, and there's like all the radio signals, and this is, you know, and this can broadcast or receive. And the kalb or the kulub, it's just so central to Sufism, you know. It's not just the same as saying heart, you know. It means something a lot more significant. So he's using all these Sufi terms throughout it, and I'm just giving him as another example because it's, you know, he's still studied today in Judaism, and this background isn't known. You know, people don't know this when they have Chovot HaLevavot, which Yehuda ibn Tabon translated into Hebrew from Judeo-Arabic. There's so much lost in translation, you know, not just that the one-to-one ratio of word meanings is lost. Sometimes it's not, but the Sufi concepts and that environment that Rabbeinu Bachya was writing in. And Rabbeinu, he's like in many cases, people who are considered really, really good rabbis are called Rabbeinu, like our rabbi. Like he's not just the rabbi of this congregation or whatever, but the rabbi of Jewry, you know. So this is, you know, this is another heavyweight, like the family of the Maimonidean dynasty. So he's not only using typically Sufi terms, pregnant with Sufi meaning, in Arabic, he's not only, you know, like a lot of these authors, a lot of these rabbis, calling God or Hashem Allah without batting an eye, which even if you look up on probably Wikipedia or some online Jewish encyclopedia or something, you could see Maimonides' Arabic name has the word Allah in it from his parentage. So this wasn't at all, you know, I have copies of Judeo-Arabic Torahs that you could see right on the first page, transliterated, Aleph, Lamed, Lamed, Aleph, Hey. So it's transliterated. They even spell it out, so you can't even say, well, maybe this is like the Aramaic Elah, or, you know, so Ha Elah, but no, just plain out Allah, you know, in Arabic, and nobody batted an eye. Nobody said, well, isn't that a moon god, you know, that the primitive Arabs worship? These ideas didn't, they were completely foreign to these communities. No one was having a debate like that. Nobody was having these Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer sort of Islamophobic, scared tactic type things, you know, the politically incorrect guide to Islam and the Crusades or all these ridiculous books that come out by these self-appointed experts. But not only was Rabbeinu Bahia using these terms, but he was quoting Muhammad and quoting Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law, quoting famous ahadith, famous oral traditions that were later set to pen. And eventually, because Rabbeinu Bahia's work was so widely studied and respected, eventually you have the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of modern Hasidism, which incidentally, they took their name from these Judeo-Sufis. This Judeo-Sufi term for a Sufi was a Hasid. And so when he wanted to revive Judaism in the wake of the failed messianism of Shabtai Tzvi, he looked to these Judeo-Sufis. And when we see like a Hasidic Jew, like that all kind of came in this roundabout indirect way from these Judeo-Sufi rabbis and communities. So the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of modern Hasidism, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonoi, he's quoting Rabbeinu Bahia, quoting Muhammad, not knowing that he's quoting Muhammad. So he says, a great Hasid once said, upon returning from a battle, that we have just left the inferior battle, and now we return to the greater battle. And then his disciple said, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonoi, quoted Rabbeinu Bahia, quoting Muhammad, O teacher, what is the greater battle of which you speak? And he says, it's the battle against the ego and its instincts. This is one of the most famous Islamic hadiths, a hadith. It's certainly among Sufis, certainly. And in the Judeo-Arabic version of Rabbeinu Bahya, the term, of course, isn't battle. The term is jihad. And of course, he did not bat an eye at using that term, because in the Sufi context, and really in the Islamic context, the term does not refer to conquering and going out and killing the infidel, as people presume in the West sometimes, but it refers to any struggle. It's just the word for struggle. That's all it means. So, of course, naturally, when there's any struggle that's physical, people will use the term jihad, because it's another language, you know. So it becomes boogeymanized in English, and we say, oh, jihad, you know. Any different fighter, a mujahid, because it's a fighter, it's a struggler, you know. But the famous hadith says, upon returning from a jihad, a battle, they inquired this very same thing of Muhammad. And he said that the greatest struggle, the jihad al-akbar, is the jihad an-nafsa, the jihad against the nafs, which is like the Hebrew nefesh, the ego self. So Rabbeinu Bahya quotes this, and he knows some people aren't going to be too keen on him doing that. So he doesn't say, Muhammad said this. He says, a great chassid once said this. And he says the same thing about Ali, and there's several examples of him doing this. So he's quoting Talmud, quoting Torah, quoting the prophets, and then he'll just throw in some Muhammad and Ali, and without batting an eye. And in that way, he wasn't an anomaly, because we have people like the leader of the Yemenite Jewish community, which is a particularly interesting community in terms of Jews and Muslims trying to understand one another. But Rabbi Netanyahu ibn al-Fayyumi, he wrote a book that has a quote that probably articulates most clearly what he saw as the correct Jewish perspective on Muhammad. And I think this is really interesting, because even though it would probably make a lot of people's jaws drop, it's a very, very balanced view that really any Jew or Muslim who's really investigated the matter shouldn't find particularly offensive. And what he said was that, in his view, Muhammad, sure, he was a prophet, but he was a prophet to the nations. That was his role. And his role was to spread, you know, all sorts of good stuff to nations that were immersed in darkness. And this is a very orthodox Islamic view of what Muhammad's role was. The Quran says this. It says that he was the prophet to the nations. It's using the same sort of Jewish language. And no Muslim would deny that the Arabian world was in utter darkness before Muhammad came. People were murdering female babies, infants, when they were born. Ah, that's a girl. I don't want a girl. Just go bury her, put her in the desert. There were all sorts of horrible things that were going on. And along comes this guy. And suddenly you have this global heavyweight, you know, the Arabian people. I mean, even Arabists like Michel Aflaq, who founded the Ba'ath Party long before Saddam became, you know, the guy that we think of, he was a Christian. And he wrote about how Arabs should still recognize that there would be no Arab anything without Muhammad. So this is what Rabbi Netanyahu ibn al-Fayyumi said. He said, it doesn't have to be this thing where we accept that Muhammad was a prophet and then leave Judaism, or we stay in Judaism and say, nah, he was a bad guy, you know, forget him. You know, the Talmud gives examples of Gentile prophets. You know, throughout it, there are numerous examples. Bilam ben Beor is an example that the Talmud calls a non-Jewish prophet. So he didn't see anything at all wrong with saying, you know, well, sure, you know. And this, so you don't have just these two guys then. I mentioned earlier that there was this rebellion against the Abbasid Caliphate, after which you have all this anti-Jewish literature and propaganda coming about in the Muslim world. In this rebellion against the same caliphate that, as I mentioned, Muhammad's own family was rebelling against, as they rebelled against the previous one before them, the Umayyads. When Shia Muslims celebrate Ashura, this is commemorating, I should say, commemorating, and in some ways celebrating, the martyrdom of Hussein, who was Muhammad's grandson, who was killed along with his infant son by the leaders of the Muslim world at that time, you know. So there wasn't this view that, like, here's this, homogenous Islamic view, and Muslims have always been in line with, there's always been very different views, just as in Judaism and Jewry, there's always different, you know. If you take a very insulated, Hasidic community, maybe in Israel, that doesn't want Sephardic kids coming there because they watch TV and they don't want them to be a bad influence, and maybe they yell at the Ethiopian immigrants and call them Kushites and all this stuff. And, if you take that person and then compare them to, like, a Reform or conservative or even modern Orthodox Jew in the Dayton, Ohio area, I mean, it's apples and oranges, you know? So to the perceived other, though, it's just Jews. Just like a lot of times to the Jewish community, Muslims are Muslims, you know? And so, you know, part of this is about breaking down that, not just looking at the modern things, the hard truths that we have to look at on both sides, for reconciliation, which is, of course, I probably should have said what Hashlama means ultimately is reconciliation, comes from the root of shalom. For there to be reconciliation, there has to be this looking at these hard truths, accepting that, you know, bad things have happened, and thus giving the perceived other dignity by saying, yeah, that sucks that happened. You know, I'm sorry that your parents or your grandparents fled during the wars because they didn't, you know, maybe they didn't have a lot of the people who fled during the 47 through 49 wars were the people who liked the Jewish immigrants. A lot of the people who fled, they thought, well, let's just get out of here. You know, there's these crazy people fighting that, you know, let's let this get sorted out and we'll come back. You know, then overnight they found out they couldn't come home. You know, pretty soon they didn't like Jews, even though, you know. So it's not this simple thing where those people were bad, so we didn't want them to come back in. But from the Jewish perspective, from the Israeli perspective, the Israeli Jewish perspective, I should say, because, you know, 20 to 30% of Israel are Muslims, of the Israeli citizenry are Muslims. From their perspective, these people just, you know, these nations just tried to attack us and wipe us out. We can't let them come back in, you know. So it's this very complicated situation. And the politicians have proven that it's not going to get sorted out at the negotiation table. You know, how are we going to divide up the proverbial baby brought before Solomon? And, you know, that it's not quite that simple. There are underlying issues that have to be addressed. And the issues aren't about bargaining. They're not about, who gets what in the divorce. You know, it's something that goes back a really, really long time, longer than anyone involved in the negotiations really understands. And only by getting to the roots of all of this, which, you know, nerdily, boringly enough, involves a lot of discussion of history. Only by doing that and both sides seeing that, can there really be healing, you know, because the reconciliation here is really something I guess we could more closely approximate as healing, using history as therapy in a way. Because I think most people are good people, you know. Sometimes days like today with, you know, the bad news, it's easy to forget that. But most people are good-hearted. And when they get off the internet and sit down, you know, the average Jew sits down with the average Muslim and talks to each other and shares and says, okay, I'm going to remember that rabbinic maxim of the two disciples. I'm going to keep that in mind. I'm going to shut my mouth for a minute, and I'm going to listen to them and realize that they're not stupid, that the Proverbs say every man is right in his own eyes. And that's because we don't really believe anything because we're stupid, per se, anything that we strongly believe. There's some element of truth to it. You know, there's some, and this is what Jewish mysticism teaches as well, that there's a spark of holiness, even in something very ugly, even in something very dark. So even if somebody believes an extremist ideology on either side, ultimately, they got immersed in that because of something that they saw that was a spark of truth. And that's hard to, you know, that's hard to look at. That's a hard thing. I remember after 9/11, I don't know if it was Peter Jennings, it was that Saturday, he sat down, whoever it was, sat down with little kids. It was a Saturday morning thing. They canceled out the cartoons. My son was very upset. He wasn't that old yet, but he still, you know, he liked his cartoons. And this little girl asked the question that, I mean, this became actually pretty famous. She said, "Why do they hate us?" And his answer, I thought I was going to vomit. He said something to the effect of, you know, it's just evil, you know, like there's just evil in the world. And that represented to me the unwillingness of American culture to put themselves in someone else's shoes. Now, it doesn't mean that the people's shoes who we're wearing, you know, don't have stinky feet. You know, that it doesn't mean that we have to keep those shoes on, you know. But for a second, you know, we need to be able to look at something, even someone as despicable as a terrorist, and say, how are they seeing things? If, as the Proverbs say, every man is right in his own eyes, how do they see this as right? And when we do that, whether it's with, you know, very extreme people like that, or whether it's just the average, everyday Palestinian, you know, or vice versa, the average Palestinian who might completely demonize the Jewish people, and I mean, many of us probably know that Mein Kampf is a bestseller. This is not propaganda that just the ultra-white right wing are saying. It is a bestseller in the Muslim world today, and that is by design. Adolf Hitler had custom written two Arabic translations, working with Islamic scholars to market it towards the Arab people, knowing that if he could get them to do a lot of the dirty work, you know, he could carry on, you know, with other people getting their hands dirty. And he broadcast, what did they call it? I can't remember what they called it. Might have been called Radio Islam or something, you know, really ridiculous. But they broadcast 24/7 in Arabic to the Muslim world. So now when we're seeing a lot of this hate in the Muslim world against Jews, against, you know, Egyptian TV and Al-Manar, which is Hezbollah TV in Lebanon, having these sitcoms resurrecting blood libel, you know, having Jews. I mean, these are things you can find on YouTube. Having the secret Jewish cabal come and take the kid and cut his throat and to make the matzah. I mean, this is a real sitcom. This actually happened. It becomes easy to forget it becomes easy to forget that there was ever a time when it wasn't like that. And if you've ever seen the movie The Zohan, or You Can't Mess with the Zohan with Adam Sandler, a really, really funny movie. but at the beginning, he was like a Mossad agent, a special forces guy, and he wants to leave the life of being a special forces superstar and move to New York and be a hairstylist. And as he's sitting at the dinner table, and you know, his parents and him are eating, you know, hummus. His dad's scooping the hummus with his glasses and all of this. You know, he says, "Dad, but you know, we kill them, they kill us. You know, when will it ever end?" And he says, "Well, it's been going on for 2,000 years. It can't be much longer." And you know, it's funny, but it's and I was raised in that belief. I was raised in an even more ignorant belief. I was raised in the belief that it's been going on since Isaac and Ishmael, which is, you know, just another classic example of how we can forget our own tradition, and how Jews can forget Jewish tradition just as easily as Muslims can forget about these awesome Sufi things, can forget about the Constitution of Medina when Muhammad drafts that Jews and his followers in Medina, which he was invited to lead, more than half Jewish city invited him to be their leader. He writes in this constitution, Jews and his followers constitute an umatan wahidatan, so one umma, one nation. An umma is a Hebrew word, actually, and it's the term that the Muslim world uses for the Islamic nation, for all the broad Islamic world. So one umma. Every time the Quran uses the term umma, it actually means one religious community. So just like Muslims can forget that stuff, you know, I could be raised hearing that, you know, Muslims and Jews, Arabs and Jews rather, Ishmaelites and Jews have been fighting since Isaac and Ishmael. And really what Judaism teaches is very different. While you do have the estrangement of Jacob and Esau, and you do have some almost reconciliation at points, you never have a Rabbi Esau. We do have the Talmudic Rabbi Ishmael. You know, this was not a boogeyman name to call your kid Ishmael. And Rashi, the preeminent Torah commentator of the medieval period, he explains, he breaks, he's really great at breaking down the Hebrew. A really good sort of intermediate Hebrew instruction is reading Rashi's commentary on the Torah, because he uses very simple language. It's you know, almost elementary, maybe a little more than elementary. But he'll look at the nuances of a word, and he'll say, "Why is this said? You know, the devil's in the details. Why is this said?" And with regards to Ishmael, when he dies, he talks about him expiring, and he says this phraseology only happens if someone's a great tzaddik, a great saint. So this, the Torah is telling us that it considers Ishmael to be a great saint. It also says that Ishmael came back to the land of Canaan and buried Abraham with his brother. It doesn't spell that out, but it says Abraham was buried by both of his sons, by Isaac and Ishmael. And of course he had other sons, but these two, you know, and so there's this whole midrashic story about Abraham going and visiting him all the time, so he wasn't this deadbeat dad, you know, and he was old, he was an adult when he finally was sent off anyway. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because they want to bring everyone into the conversation.
Yeah, it's a forum.
Because we've kind of gone real deep, and we need to, I think, a little bit, go back,
yeah,
a little bit. So I have some questions, but I want to open the floor to some questions before I open up, because I have a lot of them. So I do want to kind of open the floor and bring other people into the conversation, just along with some of the things that might have presented to us up to this point.
You talked about the historical relationship. Can you give a little more detail? How did that work?
Yeah. Well, I think when it finally ends, there is this this event in Jewish history that people typically don't talk about. I mentioned the guy's name in passing, but Shabtai Tzvi was this false messiah. And most of the Jewish world believed he was the messiah. This was in the late 17th century. And he was eccentric, to say the least, you know, arguably insane. And people, when word spread about him, it was usually by letter, so people could, you know, really sell this guy. You know, a lot of people didn't actually interact with him. What ended up happening is the Ottoman Empire said to him, "Oh, you're the Messiah. Well, how about this? You convert to Islam, or we cut off your head." And he said, "Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah," and he converted to Islam, and that was it. And everybody, he said, I bear witness that there's no God but God, and Muhammad's his messenger. And he told all his disciples, you got to convert to Islam, leave Judaism. And so not like Rabbi Nathaniel ibn al-Fayyumi. Yeah, Muhammad, he's a cool guy, he's a prophet, sure. But, you know, he wasn't sent to destroy Judaism. But no, very much like stop being Jews, stop being practicing Jews, leave behind Jewish identity, and embrace wholeheartedly this normative Islamic identity. And everybody could obviously see through it that he was just saving his skin, you know. A small group called the Donma continued, they followed him, and some argued that they were crypto-Jews for a while. But even within Turkish society, everything's, you know, the way here people talk about the Freemasons and the Illuminati, every time something happens, you know, this conspiracy theorist will always say stuff like that. There in Turkey, it's the Donma, the Donma. The Donma is the secret. You know, it must be the Donma. They must secretly be this crypto Jew, you know. So when that happened, that we don't have any real movements of Jewish and Muslim interaction anymore, I do randomly come across something like some weird anthropologist in like the 1800s or something who will just like meet this Jewish tribe in Yemen or somewhere, and he'll comment on they think Muhammad's a prophet to the nations, but not superseding Judaism for Jews, you know. So there seem to be pockets where this, you know, might have continued. All of that, of course, went away when the Yemenite community fled to Israel. Their children and grandchildren adopted a more or less assimilated Israeli identity, which is really kind of its own unique identity. But even then, it was pretty much gone. It was pretty much gone after the late 17th century. How it worked, it was a little different in each country and in each era. Like I said, with Maimonides' son, Avraham, we know that he had interaction with Sufis, and we know that he would pull Sufi stuff in to his, to his community. But with his two sons, David and Ovadia, we see an even more tightly knit relationship with Sufis. So, and then by the time you get to some of their descendants, we have people writing. We have a lot of this stuff from letters found in the Cairo Geniza. So when the Cairo Geniza, when there are a lot of Jewish documents with holy names in it, you're not supposed to burn it. You can do whatever you want, but this is like the sort of, you know, orthodox view of things. And even at the conservative shul where I go to, we just recently had a big burial of documents. So you bury it, and sometimes people find it, you know. So the Cairo Geniza was this big, you know, cachet of documents, mostly in Judeo-Arabic in Cairo, that were discovered. And so this gave us even more insight. When people write a book, they, you know, they put on their face what they want you to see. You know, that this is my book, you know. But they don't see the everyday, you know, how that works out in every day. So we see, like, from from Abraham, the son of Maimonides, we see how he wanted to, you know, present this idea. We can't necessarily tell from that, you know, too much of what was going on. We just see sort of glimpses. But from these documents in the Cairo Geniza, we have wives complaining to the Maimonidean leader of the Jewish community at that time, that their husbands off in the Sufi study circles too much. Now, these are not people who've converted to Islam. These are fully practicing Jews, and you know, their wives are complaining in some cases that they're off with the Sufis too much, and you know, in the mountains at meditation retreats. So, like I said, it differs a little bit from one era to the other. In Yemen, the aforementioned Rabbi Netanyahu ibn al-Fayyumi was very much into a group called the Ikhwan as-Safa, which Safa is also from the same root as Sufi. And the Ikhwan were Neoplatonists, and Rabbeinu Bahya ibn Pakuda also seems to quote them a lot. And they were a Sufi Muslim Neoplatonist group that we have some pretty strong evidence that some of these different rabbis were involved with too, as Jews, as sort of Sufic Jews. So that gives us a little more insight into it. And at the same time, that was a somewhat secret group, so we don't have like the minutes of their meetings per se. We just have sort of knowing that they're quoting, you know, this group, and then seeing the other literary works that they produced, and then having these letters and stuff. And it gives us some pretty clear indications of what was going on. But at the same time, no formal structure for, like, this is how they did things. And it does seem that it changed from era to era, too, as it should.
That picture, I think, was taken about 65 years ago when she was a student here. And she became a very strong advocate, not just in words, but in action for what she wanted this building to be called. Center for Cultural and Religious Freedom. You've given us a really strong bunch of illustrations, historical and a few contemporary, of ignorance, but cultural infusion too. Mm-hmm. And here we are in the Yellow Springs, most of us, maybe all of us, related to Antioch College or Antioch University. We don't face anything like Coretta faced real serious misunderstandings, divided, angry opinions. And I'm wondering, what do the half dozen of us here think? What do we do with this? If we were in the midst of a conflicted big community that had really solid Muslim and Jewish and maybe even Christian identifications, then I think we wouldn't be sitting here quite so passively. I think we'd feel, yeah, something's got to be done, but that's not our world. So what do you think? What do we do with these stories, these portraits of
That's part of the privilege of Yellow Springs, I guess, is that it's this little island where, you know.
Well, I'd like to hear from Mom. Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question. In my case, I listen to this and I feel like a total outsider to it. I'm not religious at all. I don't care what some guy did 500 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. I think that a lot of the problem comes from the fact that people do care what they said to each other and did rather than what they're doing to each other now. And I don't understand that attachment to that. And I think that it has, you know, if it were you and me being uncivilized to each other within, you know, not between religion, but just two people, the people around us would say, you know, what's the matter with you two? You know, get it together, be peaceful. But because they were not getting along with each other, you know, 1,000 years ago, and we remember it, we think we attach some great importance to it. When we really should just dismiss it and say, those are two idiots, and leave them alone, and let's act like human beings to each other now. The fact that there's some long tradition of people remembering the idiots, you know, or maybe they were great, but so what, you know? So, you know, because either you attach yourself to something somebody did good 2,000 years ago or something somebody did bad 2,000 years ago, and because it's that old, you think it's important. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
But you have these tremendous traditions that people are, you know, steeped in for their entire lives, and they can't let go of it. And they rely on these old stories to try to negotiate it, when if they just let go of the stories, they'd do a lot better at negotiating.
It's really powerful in the context of where we are now.
What I think about, really, when I was younger, I used to be, you know, a little more down on organized religion. And I think I looked at it very much like you were expressing. And I suppose the conclusion that I came to is that, unfortunately, throughout human history, we have looked for any excuse whatsoever to kill the perceived other. Even going back to the Homo habilis folks who left Africa and went into Europe, and now we know from the Neanderthal Genome Project, pretty much killed all the Neanderthals and gradually drove them further and further until they got to, you know, Portugal and Spain, and we have no more records of them. And it goes in sort of historical increments like that. And that was well before we have any notion of religion per se, but we still had this, you know, something very negative in us that wanted to harm the perceived other. And maybe they had some Hatfields and McCoy type of feud, and it was the Homo habilis and Neanderthal feud, I don't know. But I look at it more like that, more like a family feud that people then reinforce with myths that they already had, you know. Like I said, you know, I was raised being told that Isaac and Ishmael we've been fighting since Isaac and Ishmael. And, you know, not only did that turn out not to be true, but it showed me how politics and political divisions that had nothing really to do with religion per se then became cemented and reinforced with religion. Religion became the political conflict of Israel and Palestine became reinforced. And we just don't see anything in terms of literature and recordings or anything from, say, the 40s or the 30s or even before that, where there was this widespread religiousized opposition to Muslims from, you know, Jewish speakers or authors, and we don't see really the same from the Muslim camp either. Sure, there were random people who didn't like each other on both sides, but really in that short of a period of time, this became a religious conflict. It didn't really start out as a religious conflict. Even if we look at the Mufti that I mentioned, he was really most inspired by secular Arab nationalism. Nationalism itself was a very anti-Islamic idea, and Muhammad spoke against nationalism. And the term, the classical Arabic term for it, is asabiya, which is the same term as racism. Some of his descendants said, if you have even this amount of asabiya nationalism or racism in your heart, then you're doomed, basically. So just in this short period of time, it shows me sort of sociologically how something that was completely, I shouldn't say completely, but more or less a secular conflict that was incidentally between people of two different religions. It was not as though the Jewish immigrants who came into Mandate Arab Palestine saw themselves in the way that the Puritans saw themselves when they were coming to, you know, the new promised land of America. No, it was very different. And of course, Theodore Herzl was not a religious person, the founder of political Zionism. As far as anyone knows, he was an atheist. So a lot of this was very sort of secular political. Arab nationalism was secular political. And then as it became very inflamed, people retreated to religion to reinforce their hatred. And then they would look and say, Isaac and Ishmael, you know, or whatever, you know. But unfortunately, you know, I almost wish it was that simple to me, that you know, that it was just religion, and if we could all just evolve past it, that everybody would be nice. But I really see it as going in the opposite direction. I think religion is just something sort of sociologically that humans have done for the past 25,000 years. And in terms of rituals associated with belief in the afterlife, not necessarily in the sense of an organized religious institution. It's just something that we have sort of been doing, and it may evolutionarily be something that gets us, that keeps us going. Whether it's true or not true or whatever, that's a different judgment. And I think that aside from that, we just have sometimes brutal impulses, territorial impulses, and that, I think, is the core problem that we have to evolve past, is this sort of very primitive, animalistic, territorial disputes, family feuds, clan feuds, expanding into nation-state feuds, and that's what we've always taken those and then assigned religious meaning to them. And I think that we can use that example, or we can go back even further to the Crusades or anything. And I think you can argue that for the Crusades as well, that they were given a religious veneer, and it was really about the Catholic Church's fear of foreign power spreading into Europe more than it was. It was about power, and it was about territory, and to motivate the masses to be willing to die and go to, the pearly gates, you had to use religion, whether consciously or subconsciously. I'm not necessarily saying that the people, calling the shots didn't believe their own shtick, but it doesn't really change anything on the field. Anyway, that's my view. Yeah.
Strikes me is that, which relates to Al's point, I think, when we bring it back home, in the following sense that what I see the tragedy of two people to define themselves as distinct, in a sense, Israelis and Palestinians, let's say, both have claims to the same piece of land, both live in extreme insecurity, whether the bravado reveals it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, and it affects their reading of each other and reading history, the use of history to justify their position to defend themselves against critiques from the other side. And the entire dialogue about religion history is all use of these forms of discourse and basically a struggle for the land of legitimacy. It's not even legitimacy, it's to struggle for the land. And the fear of many Israelis is that the Palestinians will never give up trying to get what they regard as their land back all the way to the sea, I think. That's the extreme nightmarish vision of this, right? The Palestinians fear the Israelis will never cease in their effort to do whatever possible to get all the Palestinians out of from the sea to the Jordan. And that this implacable contradiction between two totalist visions for who owns the land, who has a legitimate right to the land, who's been dealt the worst historical injustice, is what goes on a daily basis before our very eyes when our governments are unable to do anything about it. It's as if two neighbors are tearing each other apart in front of our eyes, and well, they have to solve it themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you going to solve it? How are they going to solve it themselves when each leader is at the crest of a wave that deeper parts of which are going to demand more than can be received? Each has to be more hard-lined to survive for their own constituency than is possible for reconciliation to ever occur. neither side has many Sufis who believe in the unity of being, much less want to live that.
Yeah.
So I feel like there needs to be a question of responsibility. The parallel with civil rights in the United States is, to me, quite simple in the sense that justice cannot be ignored. Justice is what's at the heart. Justice is the tearing of the heart. Okay? And you can't be whole or be whole with others unless you heal that heart, unless you address these questions of justice. Normally, questions of justice are addressed in courts of law, where there are means to which you can address the issues that have been raised in order to come to some solution. What I don't understand is why we can't achieve that kind of resolution. What kind of court of law could address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to achieve a solution that is relatively, you know what I mean? You can't have it. They both can't be, they're both right, in a sense, but
yeah.
How do you make two into one on the same piece of land? This is a riddle, I suppose. But that needs to be addressed, and I think somehow putting the burden on the combatants to negotiate it has created absolutely unfair and irresolvable dynamic. It almost seems intentional.
It does at times, doesn't it?
It is not the way you do it. So that's my puzzle, and I think that the United States government bears some significant responsibility because they alone, in the current circumstances, have sufficient legitimacy and power to strong arm a solution that I think can be achieved here, which will create security. Security is when both sides agree they're not going to push any further.
Right.
Once you don't have that agreement that each side won't try to push the other, then nothing will hold.
I think the big problem with this specific, you know, manifestation of conflict or territorial dispute or anything is that everybody is still thinking of it in terms of how to negotiate a two-state solution. I think a two-state solution will happen. And I think, this is my own personal belief, this is not like speaking on behalf of all Hashlema chapters or blah, blah, blah. But I think it will fail, the two-state solution. And what I think will happen, probably a third party like the UN will have to step in and intervene. What I would like to think it could evolve towards is something that's neither wholly a two-state solution nor wholly a one-state solution, but a one-state federation, a one-state federal solution, in the same way that Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana are three individual states under one federal government. We could have Gaza, we could have the West Bank, we could have Israel as three separate states, all with their own unique identities and leaderships. This would also solve the problem for the Palestinian state, which Hamas does not want Abbas to be the leader of the Palestinian state, because then, you know, that, you know, they're out of a job, you know. But you could Gaza state, West Bank state, they could see themselves as one state or whatever. They could negotiate how they wanted to be seen. And Israeli state. This then solves the socio-religious issue for Israelis of maintaining the Jewish character of Israel, but all under one federal jurisdiction. So if you want to travel, it's no more of a problem than traveling between Kentucky and... And let's say you want to move. Okay, you want to move from Israel proper to Hebron, which was a historically Jewish community, where there are Jewish prophets buried, actually in a mosque, and they built a mosque around it, and Jews and Muslims worship there together. Ironically enough, in the West Bank, settlers and And Muslims worship in this mosque together. This is a little known fact. And so, you know, so you want to be a settler, you go and you pay, you know, if I want to move to Kentucky, I move to Kentucky. But then I pay taxes to Kentucky. I may also pay a federal tax, but I'm no longer paying it in Ohio then. I could still think of myself as an Ohioan at heart if I want to. You know, my mom still thinks of herself as a Hoosier. You know, it's been a long time since she's lived in Indiana. And that's probably how the settlers who would no longer be settlers would think of themselves. They'd think of themselves as Israelis, but they'd be living in Hebron or wherever else in the West Bank or Gaza. Probably less would be interested in that. And the West Bank would get taxes from them. There are all sorts of, so then people say, well, what about security issues? Well, you could have local law enforcement, you could have federal law enforcement. You know, in this way, sometimes we try too hard to figure out things that have not simple answers, but more simple than we're making them, you know? Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think the South African example of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions might be useful given all of the background and outstanding contention that exists? I mean, issues that have, you know, like houses being bulldozed, things
right.
Like that. In other words, the whole issue of responsibility for historical incidents from...
I think there needs to be responsibility, and I think there needs to be acknowledgement on both sides. I think that's important. It's one of the. I think that's one of the problems with the United States is that we rarely have a president stand up and address historical injustices and say that was wrong on behalf of the United States of America. I'm apologizing to X, Y, or Z group about that. You know, nothing that we do can make up for the fact that that happened. Thankfully, we've evolved past that. And, you know, and acknowledge that you know, that if somebody's down in a pit, they didn't necessarily just jump down the pit. Maybe they were pushed. And maybe when they tried to climb out, somebody kept, you know, kicking them down. And so the first thing you do is you make sure nobody's kicking them down anymore. But, you know, then it helps to give them a helping hand up and say, we're sorry that you got pushed down the hole. We're not going to pretend it was your fault. I do think that there can be usefulness to some formal means of addressing that. But I think because of the nature of this particular conflict, and because it is so ambiguous, not that injustice is ambiguous, I don't think that's the case at all, but that both people's claims to the land in non-religious terms, just in historic terms, historic residents and expulsions and returning periodically just to be expelled again. And, you know, sometimes we have this vision of the Romans expelling Jews and no Jews lived there anymore. And, you know, and then just one day Theodore Herzl came along and got this idea and Jewry was like, yeah, that's a good idea. We should, that used to be important, you know, maybe, you know, but that there was always this longing, you know, always, you know, next year in Jerusalem. It's always been there. And that there's always been a community there. I think having too structured, because of those factors, I think having too structured of a sort of formal sitting down the sides and making them work things out, I think is going to only get us so far. I think there has to be something coming from the grassroots with Jews and Muslims and with Israelis. And that's what I'm trying to do, is something like that, you know, just basically showing that that's possible. Because I can't tell you, growing up as a teenager, actually how I got a lot of interaction with Muslims initially was just going to protests and rallies, just not saying, I'm on this side or that side, but just saying I support, you know, Palestinian human rights. You know, I support the dignity of Palestinians. I think we can all get along. And going and saying, like, I perceive you as a human. You know, let's talk. I'm not afraid of you. You know, oh, yeah, I'd love to come to your house and have dinner. And, oh, now you're going to pop in, I'm going to listen to you talk about life in Ramallah, and now you're going to pop in a VHS of settlers shooting tracer bullets, shooting out your windows to prove to me that you're not making it up. And this was the fifth time it happened, and you had the VCR set up finally, and you're crying as you're telling me this, and you can't believe that a Jew is listening to this and believes you and is acknowledging that that's wrong. And, you know, and then after that, everything, then they're willing to listen. Then I can talk to them about the Jewish side of things. Because someone's not defending the right of settlers to shoot out their windows for kicks with tracer bullets being used just so they can see where, you know, if they're hitting houses or whatever. There's no other reason why they'd use tracer bullets. And you could see the green, you know. And I think stuff like that has to happen organically. I don't think it's a bad idea to have some formal imposed sort of thing, but I think with this it's so difficult, you know. Yeah.
So how do you get through to the people shooting the tracer bullets, regardless of which direction it's coming from?
Thankfully, they're the vast minority. That's the good news, is that there aren't a lot of super crazy people, whether it's on either side. And as things, if things were to take shape, whether in a two-state or a one-state solution, or I hate to even say solution, you see how they like put these words in your mouth, they say it enough, and you start to actually think that they're legitimate words. I don't think either one's necessarily a solution. But, you know, I think if they do a two-state solution, they're going to somehow negotiate residency for some of these settlers in the West Bank. I think that's going to be part of it. I think that's why Netanyahu's rushing to get as many settlements built almost inexplicably. No one can figure out like if he's on drugs or what he's doing. But you know, I think they're going to negotiate something like that. And what you do then, whether it's a one-state federation thing with three states or whether it's two states, is if people do that, you call the police and you throw them in jail. Unfortunately, right now, that would be seen as an act of war to arrest, you know, a settler for doing something like that if the Palestinian Authority were to do that. So, you know, there is the real issue, and you were hinting on this a little bit, you know, about this sort of inequality, you know, and that, unfortunately, you know, that's the ugly truth, that's the hard-to-admit truth, is no, that doesn't justify extremist actions, but it does create the environment where people gravitate towards extremism when they feel like they don't have a legitimate, my son had a conflict with somebody recently, not a fist fight or anything, but, you know, somebody was being physical with him and some friends, and he started, you know, he had complained to the teacher, didn't want to be with them. The teacher kind of ignored it, just kept them together. And then they, you know, my son was verbal with him. And this got the teacher's attention, and then the kid ended up getting punished and suspended. And but my son was being admonished too. And what I said to the teacher and to the principal was, what options did you really leave him with? I'm not one to always defend my kids, right or wrong. You know, when they do something wrong, they do something wrong. But if they didn't have any other option, you know, you you do have to hold people accountable, but you also have to look at how am I, you know, perpetuating that environment. I don't know. I don't even know how that.
Judaism and Islam have long distinguished traditions of legal reasoning.
Yeah.
And absolutely. They perhaps, along with the Roman Empire, an example of what forms the foundation, probably what today we call international law. Mm-hmm. And it would seem like in cases like this, above all, There needs to be clear international law that's applied fairly and justly, equitably to all people, and not be used as a foundation for settling the case where there are disputes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, disputes can fester forever if there's no shared basis of what exactly is the law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think,
and there is no basis for with that stuff. Yeah.
Today, who are saying that the only way to do this is to address it in a court of law, where there can be a set of procedures agreed upon in our world today, which is considered to be in the international law.
Yeah.
And there's no other recourse. That is shared.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's the law of the jungle, isn't it?
Right.
The fittest survive, it's the biggest, beats up the smallest, and that's what the law is. And I think that the process has not been able to be brought before a court of law to come to a decision is a reason why it's continuing to carry on, like, in a sense, the law of the jungle.
Yeah.
I mean, the rest is pretense, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I almost think, and I don't want to sound like I don't want to sound like I'm discounting what you were saying earlier. You know, I do think that there is a sense of ridiculousness to how people view things in religious contexts sometimes. That a person would say, "Okay, I'm not going to kill this person because this book tells me so." I do agree is ridiculous. At the same time, I also think that because religion is so thoroughly human, it's so part of us as a species, we can, on an individual level, on an enlightened individual level, say, yes, I am going to do good for the sake of being good. In fact, I mentioned Rabbeinu Bahia ben Pakuda's Duties of the Hearts. That's the whole point of his book, is that you should not be doing good to serve God. You should be doing good to do good. And, you know, and that's what he's saying is the duties of the hearts. You know, that the hearts, not of this. And he avoids the use of the term servant of God. And he never characterizes things in those terms. But because religion is so intertwined with us as a species, not in terms of the roots of this conflict, but certainly how we've retreated to religion to give it this this sham of authenticity to this conflict. Because of that, I think that there's a really important component of addressing injustice in religious terms. And certainly Martin Luther King did that. He shamed white America with religion, with Christianity. And I think there's something very effective to that. And that's something that I've been trying to do, in a way, is shame both perceived sides with their own respective traditions. You know, and a little known fact is that since the days of Rav Kook, the Israeli rabbinate has ruled that Muslims are halakhically gerim toshavim, or gerei toshav, which means a class of residents protected by the Torah who are allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael, who are guaranteed full rights and the rights to live there. Basically, the Noahide laws, if they adhere to those Talmudically, even if they don't announce that they adhere to those before a rabbinic court, they're still given this this status. And he said, well, yeah, Muslims meet that definition. And this is why the Israeli rabbinate still says Muslims can live there and be Israeli citizens, based on this little-known ruling. So you hear all these arguments from extremists about how the Muslims have no right to be there. It's this Jewish land. It's not a Jewish opinion, though. So by pointing this out, that's not a halakhically sound opinion, it is a halakhically rejected opinion, and that it's purely someone taking nationalism, trying to mask it in religion, and failing to do so, by pointing that out, you ultimately destroy their ability destroy the ability of extremists to use religion as their security blanket, as their veneer, as their mask of legitimacy. And that works both ways. It certainly, while this is a sort of technical Talmudic argument, it works even easier in a sense with regards to Islamic sources, because there's certainly nothing that supports the idea that Jews aren't allowed to immigrate to that region or any other region. So by in a sense playing the game, you take away the strongest weapon from extremists, which is hiding behind religion. Okay.
You're acting right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for all of you offered us and stay in chat a little bit. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your insight.
Certainly.
When you're here.
Certainly, anytime.
Appreciate it. Thank you, everyone.